I didn't know. Somehow I missed that there was something that I'm supposed to speak about related to stress management, and I can do that. Here's the other choice. It's something that I've been contemplating. Well, let's see. Thursday, last week I was in Minnesota, University of Minnesota, Minneapolis, and the topic was contemporary manifestations of compassion, or compassion in today's world. So one of the things that stuck out for me was a quote by Albert Einstein about the relationship of compassion and thinking freely, or, you know, out of the box, or like creative, unrestricted freedom in thought related to compassion. So I was thinking that I'd like to speak about that. False ego and selflessness and constricted freedom, freedom of thought, like he was able to think differently than most people. And how did he see the relationship of compassion with his ability to think the way that he thought? And, you know, and then the opposite, the constraints of the other kind. So, that's the menu. Stress management. He's thinking, cogitating. What do you think?
So I was thinking about one of the other topics other than stress management, but I was also thinking of another topic too, thinking of whether my patient suggests this one.
Little volume up, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was saying that I was just deciding between
those two, and you came up with the third one.
Kind of in progress.
Fine. What's the third one?
Well, in other words, I'm trying to find a way to formulate the or articulate the question, so that I'll make sure that every aspect possible can be explored.
We have us on the edge of our seat. What is it?
Okay, so perhaps not the best way of phrasing this question, but I guess I was thinking a lot about the major differences between, well, the similarities and differences between morality based on vedanta and morality based on secular reasoning.
Cool. I like that one. And she likes stress management. Then he'll say, you know, let's do a little something in stress management, a little bit on this one. And a little bit on Albert Einstein. And then we'll, like, turn the pot and see what else comes out. Okay. Stress management. Something like 8 years ago when Carlson Business School, there's a gentleman, kind of contemporary, really rich guy, businessman in Minnesota, started his own, you know, Carlson Business School. So I the first time I made a presentation on stress management was at the business school. There were a lot of people there. They were stressed out. And the subtitle was A Spiritual Approach. So I began by saying the best stress management is to not have any. And there's a name for it. It's called Vaikuntha. You know from India what that Vaikuntha means. Vai means without, and Kuntha means anxiety. No anxiety. You go to the place of no anxiety and there's no stress. And that's the name of the spiritual world of the kingdom of God. So if you're not in the kingdom of God, you got some stress to manage. So then come down. And the best way to manage stress that you do have is to have less. I'm just speaking simple terms. And that's the quality of goodness. So from a Bhagavad Gita perspective, because that's, I have to, anyway, I'll speak from the Vedic perspective. Please excuse me. But that's where I'm coming from. Bhagavad Gita speaks of the three modes of nature, and stress comes from the lower modes of nature. Passion is symptomized by ardent desire and longing, and following that intense endeavor to get a result so you can enjoy the result and control and own and, you know, be a big guy. Passion. And it brings stress. And then there's the mode of ignorance, symptomized by lethargy, despondency, depression, intoxication, madness, those kind of things. So that's stressful too. And the mode of goodness is symptomized by illumination, by search for truth, by cleanliness, regulation, purity of habit, simplicity, liking nature, and those, you know, mode of goodness. So if you can in some way or another frame your life in the quality of goodness, you'll have less stress to manage. That makes it easier. Less stress. So like, you know, the food. It's vegetarian food. And there are foods, according to Bhagavad Gita, that are in the mode of goodness, mode of passion, mode of ignorance. So select the food, select the way that you keep your, the place where you live and where you work clean, be regulated, speak the truth. I think, you know, qualities of goodness, it diminishes stress. I'm speaking very broadly now. And from that position of goodness, you can then cultivate Vaikuntha consciousness or spiritual consciousness. So some kind of spiritual practice that you do, ideally early in the morning. You know, early to bed, early to rise, you know that one. Makes the man healthy, wealthy, and wise. It promotes the quality of goodness. Resting early, rising early, doing some nice spiritual activity early. Very powerful. It will help set your day so that whatever turmoil comes your way, you're able to handle it better because you've been spiritually charged and centered first thing in the morning before you just, you know, go into the busy things of life. Part of the problem with that is the busy things want to crowd into that peaceful early morning. Yes, those that do that know. But if you do it regularly, then it becomes like a sacred space, a sacred part of your life. And it's just that you really anticipate and look forward to, and it's like ballast that brings goodness into the rest of your day. Even you have stressful things that you're dealing with, deadlines and papers and tests and things, conflicts, whatever. So having a spiritual core surrounded by the quality of goodness as much as you can. You know, so it takes some knowledge is one of the symptoms of goodness. So you learn the difference. You learn what's, you know, the distinction between this and that, goodness and the other modes of nature, and try to frame your life in goodness and put spiritual something. It gives you a spiritual connection every day. Every day, every day, every day, because regulation is a part of goodness. And that will help you manage stress. And then you'll make decisions. From that position, you'll make decisions about things that you're going to do and things that you're, you know, not going to involve yourself with, that direct you towards those two objectives: the life of goodness and something that gives a spiritual core to your life. Then I'll say they'll come down a little bit. And there's a people that don't teach a spiritual perspective on stress management. They teach like this: there's toxic stress and there is beneficial stress. It has a name. EU stress. Eustress. It's good. There's a challenge. There's like a bell curve. It goes, your performance increases as the challenge is there. So it's good to have challenges. And that's good stress. And then there's a certain point that it becomes toxic and it starts to, you know, performance goes down if the stress is too much. So it's good to push yourself. It's not good to push yourself too much. And each of us has our own capacity. So one person can push themselves more, or even one, you know, one period of time. You know, anyway, you choose that which is going to be beneficial, and you say no to those things that are, you know, it's too much. It's not beneficial. It goes into the realm of over-endeavor. Too much. And then it becomes toxic. And then the darkness comes in. So you break down. Or you feel you failed, or, you know, all those negative stressors. And, you know, as MIT students, you know what stress is. And it's not, it can be good. It can help your performance. It's good. You wouldn't be here if you shied away from things that are challenging. But set your goals, and what you do to achieve those goals, without compromising goodness and without compromising the spiritual core that's part of your life. I was introduced as living my life as a monk for 40 years and at the same time traveling. I could tell you what happened today, leaving Minneapolis at the house at 6 o'clock in the morning and getting to Boston at 5 o'clock, and it wasn't a straight line. It was, you know, without all the details. There was weather in Chicago that was so they canceled the flight. And they put me on another plane that was to leave in 5 minutes. But because there's weather in Chicago, anyway, without going all the details, I got there late. They said, you know, go to gate 12. And, you know, catch the flight to Newark, and went to gate 12, and they weren't there, and I waited, and they came back and said, oh, gate, the Newark flight is down there. And by the time it got down there, the Newark flight had left, and they said, well, let me see where I can get you on, and, you know, so, like that. It was one of those days. One of those days. There's more to it, but where's my beat at? But I had my my de-stressor with me. I was standing, you know, at three or four different counters, and they were looking at me like they normally look at somebody that just got turned upside down and expecting them to be like angry or bent out of shape. And I was just chanting. And one of them asked me, and one of them was a man from I forget, somewhere in Southeast Asia. And he just looked at me and said, "Are you a monk?" And he said, "How did you know?" He said, "I'm a Buddhist." And I said, "I'm a Krishna monk." And he said, "What's that?" So we had a nice discussion, and it was fun. I mean, I had an objective to get, you know, to be with the destination at a certain time, and it was 4 hours later with a lot of upside down and in between. But because there was a center, and you know, serving Krishna, so I don't know what his plan was, why this and that and the other thing, but that's okay. I got an opportunity to meet this nice Buddhist man and the city. And other things happened. It was so okay. So if you're if you have a spiritual conception of life, what does that mean? Who am I? If I think that I'm this body, then my happiness is in terms of what's produced from this body, like mine. That's my happiness, because I did it. I mean, this gets into the Einstein thing that I wanted to talk about, but which is letting go of the material conception that's false ego, that says, "I'm going to do it." And you all know what that one is from when you were little. You know, you can do it. Work very hard, study very hard, and you know how to get the grades, get the, you know, the recognition, and get into the special advanced placement courses, and get the, and here you are, you're here because you know how to go and get it. But a spiritual conception is different. The spiritual conception is altogether different. It's, I'm a spirit soul and not this body, because. So there's a spiritual conception of I and mine, and there's a material conception of I and mine. And the material conception of I is I'm this body. Like, you know, I'm American, and, you know, she's Chinese, and something, something, you're Indian, and we're this body. You're a man, you're a woman, and, you know, something, something. And then there's the subtle, you're intelligent and I'm not so intelligent. So, you know, the coverings of the soul, and then based on who I am, there's stuff that the body and the mind does, and that's mine. My work and the fruit of my work, and I'm attached to the fruit of my work. And my happiness and distress, stress is in terms of whether I win or lose. And the name of the game is compete. And you know, you're good at certain, we all have some gift to compete in something. And that's the material program, the material conception. And so I and mine in a material conception. And the spiritual conception is, I'm a spirit soul. There's a covering, gross and subtle covering, but that's not who I am. It's something I can utilize, but it's not who I am. It's not my identity. And now, because this is Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is asked by Arjuna, what's my duty? I'm making it really simple. And Krishna says, well, before we talk about what your duty is, let's talk about who you are. You're a spirit soul. Then we can talk about who your duty is. But if you think of duty in terms of the body, then it's a whole other idea of what duty is. Spirit soul, and then what does spirit souls do? What's the duty of the spirit soul? how do you act in this world, keeping right here in the front of your consciousness that you're spirit soul. If you can do like that, in short, that's stress management. You can still be very, very, very active. Right? Active. With a particular purpose. And with all kinds of variety, if you had some idea of the variety of things that I did, you might be surprised. It's like, I'm surprised. Right, you know, all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
I just was wondering about identity. It's kind of the whole world revolves around your identity. I mean, like, me being an Indian or me being a scientist or whatever. Everything I do, starting from the day I get up to the day, like, end of the day, I basically do everything which revolves around my whatever the acquired identity in the world.
Yeah.
How do I close that all up?
You don't have to close it up. You don't have to close it up. It's not about making it zero or negation. It's utilizing that in the spiritual conception. We have a body, we have an intelligence, we have a mind, we have a sense of identity or ego. Spiritualize the sense of identity, and then you can use all those things, but not in the material conception. It's not about closing it up. It's not about making things zero. It's getting a spiritual conception. Now, let's go ask that. How do you get a spiritual conception? And then utilize all those things with a spiritual conception. Is that a good question?
That's a good question. I just don't care. Like, stress, if I take in terms of work, so, okay, I do my work as an offering to Krishna, and I can have all those
fantastic
concepts. But end of the day, if I'm going to work, I don't know, 14 to 16 hours per day, I'm going to end up in the lab. Wantedly or unwantedly, I'm going to have stress out of work. I mean, like, once it's like, okay, even if you're devoting your truth to Krishna, still the process, the work you're putting yourself through is exhausting, and sometimes that adds up to stress.
You know, when you're working out of love, exhaustion is ecstatic.
I guess I'm not
beast at stage. I had a discussion. So it's how do you work with love? It's, you know, when you're attached to, like, you know, to someone, you work out of love and you're happy to do that. Take, the classic, the mother and her child. And when I look at what mothers do, I go, yuck, without all the detail. But mothers love it, and they want to have another child and do the same thing again, and they love it because it's love. So that's the, you know, as the mother has a love for the child, so we can have love for the Supreme and do what we do. He's given us our psychophysical nature. You have some gifts, some endowments. Where'd they come from? Ultimately, they come from God. There's other agents and, you know, personalities involved in the whole program, but it's ultimately from Him. And proof, like that, He can take it away. Like that, He can take it all away and it's gone. So, it comes from Him. Let me do this for Him. Now that's abstract because we don't have a sense of a person. So then, develop by two very simple things: chanting and hearing about the teachings of, the form of, pastimes of, the loving exchange of that lovable person. From Arvind, I heard about you. And probably from him, you've heard about me. And we haven't had much interaction. But just from hearing about you, I was thinking, wow, she must be a very nice person. And, you know, so when you, but when you associate with the person, then you have some sense of their lovable qualities. So associate with Krishna. And you come to understand his loving nature. And it becomes part of the, you know, the 12 to 14 hours. I work those many hours a day. And I'm not, I don't have the same psychophysical nature as you. I have mine. But I'm working for Krishna. And you can work for Krishna the same way. Same way. According to your nature. Because with the nature that God has given you. And work for him. You know, other people may have a different idea of who I work for. Or I may even have an idea of, you know, I've got my goals that I want to achieve, and I want to, some, you know, stuff. I want recognition, I want honor, I want a gold medal, or whatever. Some different people have, you know, their ideas. But a stress-free, a Vaikuntha consciousness is the things that you do in the course of your 10 to 12 or 14 or whatever it is, hours a day. I was sharing I'm sitting at the airport speaking to a friend who I told him what I had just been through. We were both laughing, and then we were looking at a problem and considering how to solve the problem. And I said, you know, this is really ecstatic. And he said, yeah, I wouldn't want to do anything else. I mean, it's not like I'd rather do something else than solve problems. But serving Krishna is ecstatic. It's not all about solving problems. There's all kinds of, like what we're doing right now. It's not some problem. It's ecstatic. Because there's a center. And even, you know, if everything went smoothly or everything got turned upside down like today, there's a, you know, not just go with the flow and whatever happens, happens, que sera, sera. It's, there's something behind all of this, and it's an opportunity to examine, am I connected to Krishna, or am I connected to, I'm the controller, I'm the enjoyer, passion, or I want everything to be peaceful, or I'm attached to Krishna. That was the lesson. That was why I was ecstatic. And it gave me enough. Anyway, each thing has an opportunity to serve Krishna, if that's your perspective on life. So, you know, this is maybe not meaningful to everybody in the room because that's not your perspective. But that's an approach to stress management. Frame your life in the quality of goodness, put something in the center that spiritualizes. And that it's something like making wet wood dry wood and then putting the dry wood in the fire. And it'll ignite. So the fire is that spiritual spark, and let the spiritual spark ignite in a life that's as far as you can in the quality of goodness. At least cleanliness, truthfulness, compassion, concern for the welfare of others, regulation of habit, eating foods in the quality of goodness, speaking pleasingly, and things like that. Goodness. That much. And then puts that spark of spiritual basic conviction, there's something greater than the day-to-day stuff that happens all the time. I don't know exactly what it is, but I know there's something. That much. And ignite that spark. And grow it. And it'll help in the stress management department. And then you can do all kinds of things. If that core is there. With a spiritual conception. Yes.
How do you apply that to decision making? If there's two options that are relatively similar and you don't really know which one.
That's a favorite. Let me share it with you. you know, Robert Frost, Two Roads Diverged in Yellow Wood, Sorry You Could Not Travel Both. So, here's three things. Don't be impulsive. That's passion. But rather pause. That's motive goodness. And then you look inside and say, why am I attracted to this? Why am I attracted to that? You're like introspect. And if you're not really clear, leave that pause a little longer and see, you know, what do you feel? Besides, you know, that just get out of your head a little bit and get into your heart a little bit. And, you know, what does it feel? And if it's not clear, you don't need to make a decision. But sometimes, like, the clock is ticking and you have to make a decision. You have to go left or right. When those things happen, this is my experience and suggestion, you try to think of, you know, wisdom literature that you know from the Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, great personalities represented in those literatures. And is there some lesson from them that would help me understand left or right? And there's then, you know, some inspiration, but I'm not completely sure. So make a step or two in that direction, then one or the other, being, you know, tuned in to the Krishna channel, ready to say that Krishna says, no, that you took the wrong turn. I'm ready to retrace, and I'm not attached to doing this or that, but I'm not going to be forever frozen in I don't know what to do, and so I'm just going to be like a deer in the headlights. I can't move. I'm going to move. Ready at any moment for some indication that says that that wasn't the right choice. Fine. I'm not attached. I want to do, you know, the path of wisdom, the path that makes sense, and I know it took the wrong turn. That's okay. Then you work it. So be prepared for some indications. Sometimes something, this is something that I do or others do, like, you know, just at random open up Bhagavad Gita. And my God, there's the answer right there. Just that random, there it is. Thank you, Krishna. Then, you know, boom, there you go. It happens. It's not like an I Ching or something. It's the personality of Godhead speaking.
And, what if you made like wrong decision at the beginning of your decision making, and you now at the moment you got too far, and you kind of like said about the time you spent, so you don't want to stop and like just continue doing it, though you know that it's like it's not yours. What is better, like to continue doing it?
No. If you've understood that you've made a boo-boo in the decision, and it's extended over some time, it's not okay. I just have to keep doing the same thing. If you understood it's not based on the right principle. You can't take back the decision because it's already been done. And so you accept the consequences, whatever that is, for what you've done. And then, you know, something like what her question is. Now, do I turn left or turn right? You know, do I do a U-turn? Or do I just gradually, incrementally move from this situation to a more favorable situation? I had some discussion with Arvind about that specifically. Say someone, based upon their decisions that they made, they're in a, you know, I know some people that do this. They have animal testing in their career or their work. They didn't plan it 8 years ago, but here they are. And now, you know, whoa, I don't know if I like the career, but I don't like that part of it. Now what do I do? You know, you didn't get there like that, so he can't get out of there like that either. So pause button and think, okay, I like the career, but I don't like this part of it. What might I do between now and the next 3 years, 4 years, that can keep me in the same career trajectory, but not with this part of it? And gradually, incrementally move over there. So a U-turn is, you know, then you look at your list of options, a U-turn, gradually, or, you know, and then you just select from the list of options, depending upon what's appropriate. But you don't just have to keep doing something because long ago I made a decision that wasn't so wise. I just didn't understand exactly what the consequence would be of this decision, and so I'm hitting a reset. Now, I have lots of options to think about. And at least if there's one key thing that you feel out of all of the options, this really resonates. Just, you know, spend time and energy invest in that one thing that resonates, because that may help you get out of, you know, the circumstance. Not get out of the circumstance. You bear the consequences for your decisions, but move you to a better place. On a principle-centered set of choices. I like. You look a little puzzled. No, it's okay. Okay. So now, any more on the stress management thing, or we'll go to his next question?
Actually, I would like to kind of augment that question a little bit.
Okay.
So, the thing that I don't want to just have a compare and contrast of morality based on the data and morality based on Western secular reasoning, but also I would like to add to morality based on, I guess, organized religions, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Or said differently. You don't have to add the third part, because I realize that actually involves a lot of stuff.
Yes.
When I say organized religions,
it gets complex. Because there's so much variety out there.
Yes, exactly.
Let me respond with something anecdotal, if that might chime in. Some number of years ago, I was visiting a family in Mississippi, an Indian family, South Indian family, Shridharan family, South Indian. And their son, Arun Shridharan, was the top student in the state in his graduating class, except he was 3 years younger than everybody else. No, when he was like second year in high school, he had finished high school and had the best, you know, scores of all exams. Like a brilliant young man. He went to a private school, and he was like an exceptional individual. He was chosen of, you know, out of 50 kids out of the whole state that went to Washington to meet the president or something like that. You know, I think he was got a full scholarship to somewhere, Harvard, I think. Something. So, brilliant. And the first time I met him, because he was always away at his private school, and he was home, and he just had graduated at, you know, like 13, with a top student in the state, in the graduating class. So, his question, he said, may I ask a question, which is similar to yours. Did I get asked by the friends in my class, why do you believe in God? Why don't you just say you don't really know, but you value morality? Because it's good to be good. Everyone agrees it's good to be good. So just be, you know, an agnostic good person. Why is that not a better position than saying I'm good because God said to be good? Is that close to your question?
Well, it's
secular morality as opposed to religious morality.
It's close, yes.
Close. So, here's how I answered it, the best I can remember. I have a... Maybe you met Krishna Leela here? She came and spoke? Okay, so Krishna, somebody... She, before she was doing what she was doing, she was the... in charge of... Imagine having this job. She was in charge of all the guidance counseling, counselors, for the entire public school system of the city of New York. Talk about stress management. And she shared with me that they did, you know, they kind of had a joke about what it took to get kicked out of school, out of the class, excuse me. Teacher expelling a kid out of the class 10 years ago. If they spoke out of turn without raising their hand, they would get kicked out of class. Or if they threw a spit wad, you know what a spit wad is? Paper, chew on it, and then throw the spit wad and it sticks to the wall. And if they caught a student doing that, they kicked out of the class. Now today, you get kicked out of class if you carry a weapon, or if you verbally threaten your teacher that you'll kill them, then you get kicked out of class. So that was so I said, today's immorality is yesterday's unthinkable. And so what happened between 10 years ago and today? Because there's no standard. Yesterday's morality and today's morality keeps moving depending upon vox populi. You know, a group of people get together and say, you know, that's moral or that's immoral. And then that becomes moral or immoral if it's the secular kind of morality. But when there's God in the picture, according to the Vedic perspective, it's descending. The Sanskrit phrase is dharmam hi sakshat bhagavat pranitam, which means that which is morality is coming from the Supreme. And that's the standard. Whether it's, you know, yesterday or today or, you know, 1,000 years ago. There are things that are just, you know, what to be done, what's not to be done. It doesn't move with time and tide. That doesn't mean everyone's frozen in time in terms of cultural innuendos and so on. But there are some things that are just absolute. So, being, you know, the young, intelligent person said, I get it. Now I can go back and tell my friends. So, and it's the difference between, you know, reality and illusion, or light and darkness. In darkness, in Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna asks Krishna, if people don't have faith in you and what you say, will they not have faith in something else? And Krishna says, of course they'll have faith in something else, because I'm paraphrasing, but faith is intrinsic to the soul, because the soul in the purified state has that in with the Supreme. But if you don't have that faith in the Supreme, you can have faith in something else, according to the modes of nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance. So there are people that have, you know, truth and morality for them might be in the mode of darkness, or the mode of passion, or the mode of goodness. But then there's transcendence. And reality, or morality with a capital R or M, is descending. It's God-given. Just like the gifts that we have are God-given. And they're meant to be used in service to the one who gave us those gifts. And then how to do that is also, it's, you know, there's revealed scripture that says this is how you can use the gifts that I've given. You know, there's parameters, there's a lot of creativity, but here's some standard that you should recognized. So now, you know, organized or disorganized, there's principles. So someone may do it in solitude and someone may do it with others. Principles don't change. Some may like it this way, some may, but the principles should be the same. So there's diversity. Diversity is fantastic. Unity must be there within diversity to have genuine transcendence, connection with the Supreme. And then let's say it this way. We're persons of different isms reach the stage of perfection, they'll be in full harmony. Although the place from which they came might look very different, the rituals they followed are very different, that's fine. Let the principles be the same, but take them to the same place. Unity and diversity. Diversity is fantastic. Unity is more fantastic. Okay. Any other, like, anything whatsoever? I'll speak about Albert Einstein. Yes?
I guess this could be also phrased in multiple ways, but when you feel yourself coming, getting stressed or, getting into that mode of anxiety or realizing that there is anxiety, like you are having anxiety, what do you do at that moment? Or what is the best way to kind of let it go, if not just letting it go?
You've heard the adage, count to 10? You've heard that one? It's a physiological principle. There's, what do you call it? Sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. Heard of that? So you move, and I forget which one is which, you move from one to the other. The fight or flight, stress, count to 10. So you move from that, I think that one's the parasympathetic nervous system, to the sympathetic nervous system, where you're more in a reflective mode. That's like count to 10 or 10 deep breaths. Just like release that tension. Which can, instead of just 10 deep breaths, 10 thoughtful maha mantras, because then you would also have deep breath. But where your attention goes is not just to like blank, it goes to your place of shelter. And at least in my case, or for someone who has such a discipline in their life, that the object may be other than Krishna, but they have a place of shelter. Bring your consciousness to that place of shelter. And so your question again is, in that moment when you see your step back, that's the pause, the 10 deep breaths, it's a pause, it's mode of goodness instead of the passion ignorance combination swirl. Step back, mode of goodness, and place your consciousness elsewhere. In that moment. It's especially effective if you have in the background behind you this regular sadhana or discipline that you do every morning. You go to that space, that sacred space, that shelter, that place, that consciousness. And it's not just like running away from the problem. It in fact enables you to address the problem with discrimination rather than just reactive, stressful, not very thoughtful, not necessarily the best decision and actions and speech that you'll be really pleased with later on, because it wasn't coming from the right place. So what to do in that moment? Step back. I found that happened, when the plane to Newark had gone, because they sent me to gate 12 instead of gate 3. And the lady that sent me to gate 12 instead of gate 3, she just didn't care. She didn't even look up. I'm sorry, the plane has already left. You just go to gate 12 and get the flight to Newark. Didn't even look at me. And it wasn't even the right flight. I get scared. That lady, you know, if she had just been service-minded instead of, you know, absorbing herself. Because the next guy was like, you know, he was the opposite. He really went out of his way to make sure I got on. Anyway, so I could get all, you know, this, that lady. And I didn't go there, but I was, you know, like you said, I felt, why is this happening? And I just stepped back and I put my hands in my beanbag and just immediately, because for me, that's like Krishna. And it was, boom. He was chanting very softly and he looked up to see, you know, are you going to be all right? Yeah, I'm fine. He said, I made a reservation for the next flight. I'm looking for a better one. Okay, thank you. And because of that, maybe because of that reciprocation, he went way out of his way. He went down to gate 12 to make sure I got on to the flight that was the one that was to Cleveland, not New York, or not Newark. But, you know, got me onto the Cleveland flight. Anyway, he didn't have to do that, but he did that. Krishna. So he did some service. Hey, fantastic. But, you know, so the stress, getting stressed, wouldn't help the situation at all. It would have irritated the guy behind the counter. And he couldn't have done his job as well as he did his job. Anyway, it would have had the reverse effect, even in terms of bringing a solution. So, what to do? What's your question? Step back, pause, load of goodness, connect with that spiritual core. Now, thoughtfully, what's the best, you know, thing for me to do in this situation? How to best serve Krishna in this situation? Whatever that is. And there's always some opportunity to serve in all situations of life. Fantastic. Go ahead.
I know, at least for me and a lot of my friends here at MIT, I know a lot of MIT students are very involved, and we do like to do a lot of different things. I remember you mentioned you do too much, or there's a point where it's
toxic stress. Yeah.
Exactly. So is that more of, so are you saying that to be in goodness, you should not do a lot?
No.
Or is that more of a motive thought, so that goodness it is, rather
yes,
than the amount of the activity?
Yes. Know what your capacity is, and don't, and push yourself a little bit, but know what your capacity is to push yourself more than a little bit, then it becomes the other kind. It's like physical therapy. Or like yoga. With yoga, it's good to stretch a little. It's not good to stretch too much. You can cause real damage if you stretch too much. Like I did something to my knee, had a meniscus tear. And, you know, I thought I was going to have surgery. The surgeon said, look, I'm a surgeon. I'm telling you, you don't need surgery. I said, fantastic. Now what do I do? Physical therapy. And he gave me an explanation of why. So, okay, went to the physical therapist. I couldn't bend my knee more than that. They got out one of those things, you know, compasses, and measured how, and boom. And, you know, then she said, she was a physical therapist lady, she said, oh, you're one of those types. You want to do, like, too much at once? I said, she didn't have to say more than that. I said, I get your message. Do a little bit at a time. I'll say two other things. She said, okay, what is it that you'd like to achieve? You got out a clipboard, marking checking boxes. What's your goal? It's good to have goals. He said, well, I'd like to be able to walk up and down stairs like I'm not an old man. She said, okay, that sounds good. What else? And she meant it seriously. So I said, okay, let me think about it. And I said, I'm going to India next year. Oh, friend, I have a friend that's going to India. Where are you going to in India? You know, one of those. Just, you know, it's in Vrindavan, a sacred place. And there's this hill called Govardhan. And it's 23 kilometers. And I want to be able to walk around Govardhan all 23 miles and not be, or 23 kilometers and not be in pain. He said, oh, that's good. And I'll tell you, this is like stress management. I was doing those, you know, 10 of these and 30 of those and, you know, exercises. And that was really, you know, not very enlivening. But when I was meditating on, I want to walk around Govardhan Hill, and it's going to take, you know, I'm investing this it's a transcendental, and it wasn't stressful at all. It was, and I knew don't overdo it. Don't try to do too many. Like, you know, part of it's putting weights on and then, you know, lifting with weights on. And, you know, just do 1 kg at a time. Don't take 5 of them or 10 of them. Just 1 at a time. And slowly. So, mode of goodness. But then have a spiritual goal behind, you know, working your 10, 12 hours, whatever it is that you do. Have a spiritual goal behind the activity, the psychophysical manifestation of, you know, the covering of the soul. And you stay fixed on that. And then it's stress-free. It's fun. Even you encounter, you know, people that are nasty or, you know, whatever. The thing goes wrong or whatever it is. It's just part of, you know, service. There's bumps in the road. That's okay. It's 8:30. What time do we go till? We're done, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't... Next time I come, I'll speak about Einstein.
Be a final
question.
What is the quote about Einstein?
What's that?
What is the quote?
I'll read it. Thank you for asking. He's addressing, as I said at the beginning, freedom of thought as opposed to constriction of thought, you know, as a scientist or whatever. Our task must be to free ourselves, ... by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature and its beauty, period. I wanted to speak about that. Next time I'll speak about that. Now, what's false ego? What's freedom from false ego? What's the nature of false ego? What's selfishness? What's unselfish? What is freedom? What is being controlled by false ego? You know, there's a material idea of false ego. There's a Vedic idea of false ego. How do we get it there, and how do we get out? I don't want to speak about it. Okay, we're done.